Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host as always. And today we are joined by Bronson Hill, host of the Mailbox Money Show, keynote speaker, and author of Fire Yourself, plus the upcoming book, Rich Brain. A former top medical sales rep turned real estate investor, Bronson helps people build true wealth through passive income. With over 200 million in multifamily assets and 2,000 units, he teaches everyday investors how to earn big returns without Wall Street's chaos. His mission is to help you trade time for freedom and turn your brain into your biggest financial asset. I've asked him to join us here today to share his story and insights on building income that shows up whether you work or don't. So Bronson, thank you so much for joining us today. How you doing, my friend?
I'm good, man. Good to see you. We had you on my show recently. It was great to chat, and you're an innovative guy, and so excited to talk about some innovative things here.
Yeah, it's an honor and pleasure to share more time with you. How did you even get started in this? Is this something that your parents did? Are you carrying the torch? Did you just pick up where they left off and, you know, are passing the baton into the future?
Yeah, no, that's actually interesting when it comes to a lot. You know, I did not come from money. There are people that come from money. I'm not one of them. My parents are both teachers, grew up in a single family home with four kids. So very middle class, right? And the education path of getting a, you know, the rich dad, poor dad, the safe, secure job with benefits and a pension, that's a very different road than being a real estate or, you know, investor or entrepreneur. So how I got started, really, I was a well-paid medical sales professional. I was making over $200,000 a year in my job, which is a great job, working 30 to 40 hours a week. But I had this desire to want to have more freedom over my time. I just didn't like that I had to go to work at certain times. And no matter how much I was making, it was like, and a lot of people can relate with this, is like we say we want financial freedom, but what we really want is time freedom. I really wanted the ability to take more trips and be able to create, write a book, do things that I enjoy. And so I was actually able to leave my corporate job a few years ago, having replaced my working income with passive income. So I traveled 6 times international last year. Once was to the base camp of Mount Everest. That was kind of a highlight of last year. But in the middle of learning about, you know, everybody kind of knows we should do real estate. For me, you know, I had a desire to get into it, started doing some single family investing, developed a little bit of cash flow, but I realized it was a lot of work and it wasn't going as fast as I wanted. And so basically I learned through a mentor, just how do you actually raise money for real estate? How do you raise other people's money to go do real estate deals? So fast forward now, it's been about 6 years. We've raised about $50 million now to go buy a bunch of real estate. We're doing private businesses. We're doing oil and gas, as well as debt funds, which are just consistent cash flow. But it's really three things people come to us for. It's really helping people to get more cash flow, appreciation, or tax benefits, right? A lot of people pay a lot in taxes, and there are certain investments in the US that allow you to really depreciate or reduce even ordinary income potentially with certain types of investments.
Got it. I love it. That's super powerful. So you had this job. So you grew up in this family. You decided to get into sales. You just had a natural knack for it. You became a top sales rep. You said, this sucks. That'll work. You abandoned that and then found a mentor and they taught you to make money rain from the sky. And now you take six vacations a year. Is that the story? Did I get it right?
Yeah, it's kind of it, I guess. I mean, we also do a lot of education. You know, they say great investing should be like watching paint dry, right? So it's just not super exciting sometimes. But
making
I also think
you don't want excitement. You're making money.
Yeah, exactly. But I think this is something that's true for business owners. You work with a lot of business owners, entrepreneurs. A lot of us are great at making money in our business, but we don't realize that if it's only in your business, what do you do after you make the money? If you only are making money and you spend it or you spend everything you make, you're not really getting ahead. So if you can save money, if you can invest it, how do you invest it in such a way that it doesn't take up more of your time? And this is the thing that a lot of people don't realize. People talk about passive income, Daryl, and they think, oh, I own rental houses or I have an online business or I do options trading or stock trading. And it's like, well, none of those are passive investing. Warren Buffett describes passive investing like this: unless you learn how to make money while you sleep, you'll work until you die. Right. So this is just like, what is the idea of how do I get my money after I make it? I send it to work. It goes out the front door, goes and works for me and goes and works a full-time job, comes back with more money, and it actually does the work for me without taking up my time. Right. And that's the problem. If you look at owning a rental house or two or three rental houses, could you 10x that strategy? Right. This is a test. Could you 10x the number that you have and go to 30 rental houses if you were at three? And a lot of people are like, oh my gosh, no way. It'd be too much. Even if I had another manager, they'd be asking me things all the time. It'd be stressful, whatever. Well, that's where passive investing, where you invest in different groups that kind of can help grow your wealth over time. That's what the wealthy do. That's what ultra high net worth do. They don't actually do the work on their own stuff. They have other groups that help them with their investments. And so that's a little bit about passive investing.
Got it. So passive investing is having some money, and forgive me, is having some money and understanding that, I guess it's under, like a lot of the traditional passive income investments still require work. So the true passive income is funding the people that are trying to make that traditional passive income.
I would say, to be honest, there's no such thing as fully passive income. And the reason why is because no one cares about your money the way that you do, right? You can't delegate it. You just can't. The problem, I was an investment advisor, traditional investment advisor for a few years, and I just saw all the misalignment of interest. I mean, there's studies that show that of people that manage over $100 million of a Wall Street fund, less than 50% of them have a single dollar invested in the fund. So they have nothing, there's no skin in the game. They're just managing, kind of doing what they have to do. And then there's all these hidden fees. Tony Robbins, this is an interesting idea that Tony Robbins came out with a book called Money the Game a few years ago. And it said that the average mutual fund will say the fees are 1.2% per year. This is common if people have a self-retirement plan or some sort of a self-employment plan or a retirement plan. It'll say, oh, this is a 2040 fund or 2050, whatever date you're thinking of retiring, it'll kind of set this fund there. So the fees are 1.2% per year. What they do not tell you is that there are hidden fees. They can charge 2% per year, hidden fees or more, without legally telling you anything. And if you ask and you really dig it, even the people selling this stuff doesn't even know. They don't even know, but there are things like administrative fee, cash drag fee, marketing fee, exchange, those BS fees. So it ends up bringing it up to 3.2%, 2% higher than it was. And then if you have a money person, like a financial advisor, they take 2% every year on top of it. So you're basically paying 5.2% per year if you have a money manager. Most wealthy people I know have a money manager. So they're 5.2%. The average returns per year in the stock market, if you count the down years, are 6 to 9% per year. So that is most of your money. So it can be effective at potentially not losing your money, kind of a glorified savings account. But the problem is, I haven't met a single person that has become wealthy by using those methods. And that's why getting into real assets is so important.
Forgot to add one, the 2% inflation goal.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. I mean, that's part of the whole Bitcoin thing is why are you stealing 2%? Currencies devalue every something like 40 to 70 years. Countries devalue, they go to zero. You watch the Simpsons episode. It was a single income family. Homer supported his wife, three kids. They had a nice house. Every kid had their own bedroom. So that's what? It's a 4-bedroom house and a car. And they would go on vacations off a single. That's just not happening today. I think in the early, I know this because of the project that we talked about before, the Oasis Biohome, that in the 1920s, I think it was, 20s or 30s, the average annual salary in North America was about 33% the cost of a home.
Yeah.
And now it's 8%.
That's crazy.
But people are earning way more. I'm making air quotes here. They're making way more per month now than you were then, right? But the purchasing power from the money is gone. So to your point, you're paying your 5% in fees plus the 2% inflation. I mean, you're barely treading water. So
yeah. It's so true. It's yeah. So I think when it comes to passive income, and just kind of going back to what we're talking about, what happens is a lot of people will think, I can just give it to somebody else. They can just be my money manager or whatever. But really what it involves is there is some work in passive investing. You do have to vet an operator, a deal, a team. You've got to kind of look at the market that it's in. There's a process. I talk about in my book of how do you actually vet. We've invested in venture. We've capital. We've invested in new developments. We've invested in multifamily real estate, self-storage. We've done all kinds of different investments, you know, businesses and, you know, oil and gas, different things. And so the work is really on the front of vetting the team, vetting the deal. And then when you choose to invest, at that point, you're hands off, right? It's more of a hands off. You basically, hey, I've done my work here. You take it. Like if I'm investing with you, Daryl, here's the money. Go ahead and you run the thing, the business, or whatever. And you just send me the cash when it comes in, right? And that's so, you know, you'll just kind of watch the reports and things. And I know people that are invested in over 50 or 75 different deals. I think that's too many. I think it should be like 10 or 15 maybe at the most. But people are invested in many deals and then they just get cash flow from these deals or appreciation or maybe a high end over time. So that's, I think, what good passive investing is, you know, the name of my podcast is The Mailbox Money Show. And it's that idea, right? That, you know, these checks, you know, the deposits show up every single month without you having to do it. You're not actually doing the work.
Yeah. It sounds like farming. It's like a modern day farming. Yeah. My wife's father, they own a lot of land. And
you mentioned that. Yeah. You guys do a lot of farming there and it works out really well for you.
Yeah, we have the 800 dragon fruit and I'm looking to plant more. But, you know, it's funny because him and I don't really talk because of a language barrier. I talk through my wife sometimes and he was talking about he's got some of these other lots and that I was asking about farm help because we need some hands and we're looking at other property. And we need some farm hands to help. And he said, oh, it can be tough to find good people, but when you find good people, it works really well. And we were talking about different things. And he was saying, for example, he has a lot And he's got two guys that are going to work it, and they're going to be producing about 4 tons of bok choy every 30 days. And
amazing.
He just had to, like, and when you describe what you did, I felt like I was hearing what he was describing, what he did. Like, I've got the land and I just had to find the right people and I had to do the due diligence and then boom, off you go. And then I just make sure that they don't do anything silly. And then they're going to make their 4 tons of bok choy and they're going to sell it and I get my cut and, you know,
yeah.
I own the land type thing. So
that's great.
There's another analogy to play to, you know, so that it's not completely hands-free, but it is. When you're talking about passive, I was like, it's kind of like growing a plant. We got a call today. Yeah. We got to go help harvest all our dragon fruit because they just exploded. We did a couple of changes and now we're pumping out more fruit than they know what to do with. So it's good.
That's great. I love it.
It's just a side thing. So, but for you, in terms of on your journey to doing this, I mean, being able to raise over 50 million, I think so you raised even more than that. I think it was over, you said, no, you've raised over 50 million recently. So obviously it's not all at once. What were some of the biggest challenges in doing that?
Well, I think, I mean, it does sound kind of crazy now. I didn't see myself as somebody who was going to raise money. And then I didn't see my background of being in sales for 10 years. It's like, oh, like raising capital is really raising money. So if anybody wants to raise money in their business, they want to find a way to raise money to do a project. It's actually not as hard as you think. And the reason I say that is that we have this mental barrier often that, like, if we've never done it, it feels impossible. But if I'm talking to business owners, I'm talking to entrepreneurs, it's just trying something different, right? So what I do is, let's say you wanted to raise money for your business, right? You wanted to raise money. What'd you do, right? You put together a plan. A lot of listeners have done that. And so it's that kind of thing. And so I just say, okay, well, this is what it is. This is what I'm doing. In the beginning, it was challenging because here I basically have some single family experience. I had 4 single family houses and I'm raising for a 225 unit property in Texas, right? Well, how does that work? Right? Well, I had a partner that had 15 years of experience, multiple exits, had done great. So my lack of experience in running a multifamily deal was not an issue, right? It was just, hey, I'm a leader in the space. I run a meetup locally and here's something I found. I'm excited about it. And that was how I found my first investor. He invested $100,000 in this project. And that's how I got started. So I think the hardest part is getting started. And then over time, I think it's just, as far as raising money, one thing that helps me for me is just to continue to try to add value in the space. So if I'm someone who's adding value in the investing space, I'm talking about these different investments, the tax strategy, I'm talking about, you know, different things you could be doing with your portfolio. I'm interviewing quality guests in the business or investing world, talking about my own successes and failures. People are going to be drawn to that. I actually just had a call with an investor who's invested probably about $500,000 with us the last 6 months. And they're like, you know, they came out to an event, live event we did, and they say, you know, it was so great. Like, I feel like I can really trust you. I can really trust who you are. I saw you in the room. I really got to know, like, and that's, you can't put a value to that, right? And at the end of the day, I really want to do what I feel is best for these investors. They may invest with us, they may not, but like at the end of the day, if you're someone who can be, you know, people invest with those they know, like, and trust. Everybody says, which of those is the most important? Trust is obviously important. But the first one, when you're raising capital, is they got to know who you are. So I think if you're trying to go broadly to raise capital, you got to be willing to kind of put yourself out there on social media and do a little more, just, hey, this is what I'm doing. This is what I'm, because, you know, it's people just, there's so much noise out there. Unless you're talking about something all the time, no one knows what you're doing, right? They get you mixed up with somebody else. And so it's being willing to just have those conversations and then really add value in that space.
I think that's really important. That whether you're selling a $10 item, a $10,000 item, or a $10 million opportunity, it's still the same basics of lead generation, lead conversion, and then making sure you deliver on the promise. I think the difference is obviously the risks are higher. If you're offering a haircut, your risk is a little bit less than if you're like, hey, I need to raise 300 grand. You know, to a certain point, you're signing your life to that loan, but at the same time, you've got some sort of feeling of what's going to happen on the other side of that. So that's a major, powerful way of thinking about leverage. I remember there was, I think it's, you mentioned Rich Dad, one of his books, OPM, OPR, OPC, other people's money, other people's resources, other people's customers. That's a leverage multiplier. So why don't you just go to a bank? Why don't you just go to the bank and say, hey, I got this business plan and you should invest in me.
Yeah, it's really funny how it works with banks and anybody who's taking a loan. You know, banks will give you as much money as you need as long as you don't need it. Like when you're worthy of, you have more than enough money, they'll loan you. So if you have a net worth of $10 million, they're going to loan you millions of dollars. Like, oh, this person's got the money. But when the time when you actually need money, and it's really interesting how this goes too. The larger of the loan you need, the larger the purchase, the less it's actually about you as the borrower and the more it's about the deal itself. So an example of this is we were planning to buy an e-commerce business. We ended up not closing on it for a couple of reasons. It was disappointing, but the loan we were getting was a $10.7 million loan. And we agreed to do it because it was interest only. It was, 14%. You say, well, that's really high. But it's like, well, the business was awesome and there were no assets. There was like $2 million in cash in the business. So they're going to give us $10.7 million on it. And then it was interest only and there was no personal guarantee. Right. So basically, that's pretty amazing. So personal guarantee, for those not familiar, is if it doesn't work out, you've got to find some other way to pay it back. Right. So the bigger the loan, the better. But very few groups will loan 100% to an investment deal. And why is that? It's because investment deals, business in general, involves risk. So there are very few things that without any sort of recourse, people will give you all the money on a debt basis to pay you back. Now, there are some that will, and I have some friends now and people that I know, investors, that will say, hey, I'll loan you a bit at this to help get this deal done or to kind of get things across the finish line or whatever. We'll look at that. But getting the deal done, it's using debt and equity typically. It's very rare. Sometimes you can use all equity, which is just basically all cash. But the debt is nice because then we may only have to raise 10, 20, 30, 40, 50% instead of having raised the whole thing. And then the returns are much higher for investors as well.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good answer. So the banks, I think I was really surprised about this too. I mean, I don't know, maybe if you want to talk about how do you keep the money safe when you're making it. To me, it sounds like really cash flow is a big, you said this, I think before we even hit record, like making sure there's strong, steady cash flow, perhaps. I'm not sure if I'm putting words in your mouth, but
yeah.
How do you keep it safe once you've made it?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think, right now, the thing that really most investors are looking for, Daryl, is that, a few years ago, you could just buy a single family house somewhere in the US or an apartment building and it would cash flow really well. And just by owning it, you were a genius because it would appreciate over time. Well, there have been certain areas in some of the multifamily deals we've made a lot of money and we've had some we've lost money. We've had challenges with, right? Especially multifamily real estate. But even now with single family real estate, if you buy a house these days, it's hard to find something that's cash flow positive, meaning your payment is less than what it would actually rent for, right? So that doesn't really exist. Usually rents in general, historically, rents have been higher than what kind of like you put a little bit of money down, you have your payment. Well, now it's reversed. So like, for example, we were talking about this before. I actually rent the house I live with, 2,500 units, but I rent the house I live in Los Angeles. This house is about a 1,250 square foot house. I'm in a nice neighborhood, but it'd be about between 1.2 and 1.5 million to buy this. So I need a down payment. In addition to that, it'd be about 10 grand a month to make the payment. Right? When you talk about the payment itself, the insurance, the escrow, all that stuff. But to rent this, you could rent this house for between 4,000 and 4,500. So if I owned this and I had to go move or live somewhere else and I decided to keep it, I'd be paying 5-6 grand a month just for the privilege of holding on to this, right? So it doesn't make sense. So we've looked in the last couple of years as interest rates have risen, and this exists, same with apartment buildings, it's hard to have it make sense. We've shifted to go into other assets like oil and gas, the cash flow and have a lot of tax benefits. We've gone into buying businesses. Some businesses now, they're selling for 3x profit, which is crazy. You can buy like a business that generates $1 million a year and buy it for 3 million sometimes on owner financing or other things. And it's like, so the cap rate is basically a term we use in real estate, is what's the percentage you get per year if you paid cash. Mm-hmm. So if you had $1 million home and it was a five cap rate, it means you'd be getting, what's that, $5,000 a year, I think if I did my math right. But we have some of these businesses that are 30 to 35 cap rate, right? So you go from a 5 cap to a 30-35, like it's unbelievable. And even it's, and you're lucky if you get a 5 cap in real estate. So I think in that way, we're really looking to say what actually puts money in your pocket. And in my book, Fire Yourself, I talk a lot about cash flow is what actually allows you to become financially free. A lot of money someday, buying single family houses, other long-term deals, they're not bad. It's just, they take a very long time to get there. And making a lot of money someday doesn't allow me to pay my bills this month or next year. So right. That's why cash flow is so magical.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love it. Cash is king. Cash is king. And you can make a lot happen. And a lot of businesses die because it's not that they don't have assets. It's not that they don't have inventory. They just don't have cash. And you need cash to grease the wheels to make things happen and have to pay for this license that you need in order to continue doing business, to do that marketing campaign, to whatever. And you got to have some of that cash flow coming through. So I think that's a really good for people listening. Cash is king. And to make sure that you're not betting the farm on something that's going to pay off someday. I think that's powerful.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on Bitcoin?
I own a little bit of Bitcoin. I would not say I'm a Bitcoin maximalist. There's people that they have so much money. I mean, I know people that are multi-million dollar net worth. They've got half their net worth and or most of their net worth in Bitcoin. I think it's interesting. And even the people, I know a guy I respect a lot is in the space. He says, Bitcoin is either worth $1 million or more, or it's worth zero, right? There's really no in between either. It's like super uber valuable or eventually it's going to be worth nothing. So I don't know. I mean, I think that if the governments of the world, I think like having the ability to create currency. I think it gives them autonomy. And I think something like crypto or Bitcoin could be more difficult to use in certain things if, you know, governments become strapped or there's more money that goes into that. Obviously, the current administration in the US is very open to crypto and different things. But the younger generation, when I say younger, I'm 44, people that are 30 or 35 and younger are really looking at digital assets as real assets. And yet I look at things like physical gold, you know, owning like physical gold, physical silver, real estate, oil and gas. To me, those are real assets. Because I think the challenge is when you have things aren't going well, and especially with all the digital theft. I know so many people that have owned crypto. I'd say like 20, 30% of people I know have lost substantial amounts of money, even sometimes millions of dollars, by just owning and holding crypto. And sometimes it's internal hacks through the cell phones. And I mean, there's all kinds of advanced strategies. Yeah. So that's the scary part.
He runs a fund. He just called me. Sorry, this is like to interrupt. This just happened. I had the call this week, a Father's Day. He woke up to having had his computer hacked, and his entire personal life savings were wiped out. And half of the fund that he managed, he was managing a multi-million dollar crypto fund. Half of the fund was gone. And he still doesn't know what happened. He has no idea what happened. And so the answer is cold storage, people. Cold storage. Can't hack it if it's offline.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I've done. Cold storage is important. Yeah. And but then, you know, cold storage is also a risk too. If you have it, you know, your house and somebody take it, if you have it in a, you know, a safe deposit box, what if there was some sort of bank holiday or something that, you know, eventually, I mean, there's you lose it, or it's like all kinds of.
What about your seed phrase? What about your seed phrase? I always thought, you know, if you got a tattoo of the 12, like almost like an astrology, your 12 words, but you know the combination order it goes in. You can go anywhere. You can hop on any computer anywhere, put in your 12 words and access it, whether it's cold or not.
That's true. If you have that, and some people, yeah, they'll engrave that or the code on a ring and they'll travel and different. I mean, there's always people do it. A lot of though, they think they say it's about, you might know the number better than me, but it's something like 20% or 25% of all the Bitcoin ever has basically been lost to the network. Like somehow somebody lost the code or lost the information or something. So it's like, because once if you lose that, there's actually a famous story of the guy who had, I think now it would probably be about $500 million worth of Bitcoin. And he accidentally threw the laptop away or he got thrown out or something. And so this was in England. And so they literally set up a partnership with the city to try to go in and like, piece by piece, go through the dump and see if they could track it down. They would split some of the pro. I don't know what happened. I guess I don't know if they ever found it, but pretty crazy stuff.
I think this is a good feather in the cap for things that generate cash flow, because you've heard stories of like ladies that I've heard some story, like a lady was, you know, her daughter bought her a vacation or dream vacation. She went away, came back. And when she came back, her daughter and her husband had renovated her house. It was like a surprise, but they threw out her old mattress and she'd been stuffing money in that mattress for 40 years. And so then they had to go through the dump to find it. So
did they find it?
Huh? No, I don't think they found it. I don't know the story, but I've heard a couple of different, it's one of those stories you hear a couple of different versions of, and it's Bitcoin. I'm sure all this has happened too. I mean, the billions of people on the planet. So something that produces consistent cash flow, you know, that's, I think that's a powerful conversation. I also think people need to consider also about just, and this is my own kind of agenda perhaps, but zero cost living. It's not just making couple million dollars. It's owning the land that you live on, and it's being self-sufficient to a certain extent. So you almost have no overhead. The overhead you have is like inputs to things that generate cash flow. I think that would be probably one of the best things to do. Instead of having a bunch of overhead that you have to pay simply to exist, instead you own all that. You own the land outright. You've got a solar power kit. You got power for 30 years for free. You know, depending where you live, you've got, you know, simple things set up. I'm big into permaculture. Regenerative agriculture, you know, and now you've got food. And so it's like, hey, I can just persist. If COVID happens, it's a war, if there was a solar flare, I'm good. I got some rain barrels, whatever. I can provide and survive. And now all this stuff is because I'm playing in society and trying to make an impact on the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, no, I think that's, I mean, you bring up a great point. I have a friend named Chris Martinson who wrote the book called The Crash Course. He had like an event about just sustainability. How do you, if there was a natural disaster in Los Angeles, first of all, like, oh, let's just imagine Katrina happened, some big thing. And all of a sudden, like, you're kind of on your own. There's no real support from law enforcement. You know, so how are you going to defend yourself? How are you going to get enough water to be able to survive? How do you cook your food? So, you know, we've got a solar, like a small little solar thing going that if we needed to power some small devices, we could. But, you know, you think about what would that be? I mean, we're just so dependent on you know, a lot of the things we take for granted. And like you said, to be self-sufficient is huge. And I think in a way, a lot of, at least in the US, they like keeping you dependent on the grid and on all kinds of different things. And if something were to happen, would you be able to survive? And how would you do that? I think it's great to think about it. And, you know, what are the scenario? Maybe it's a 1% chance something happened to him, 3% in the next 10, whatever, how many years. But it's to think about that, because things do happen. Black swans do happen. And people that are prepared, all of a sudden, it seems like very intuitive. Oh, yeah, I should have done that. Well, it's like, well, what can we think about now that just you have some preparation for times to come if something difficult happens?
Yeah. I think that's, and I think that's, again, it lends to the idea of generating passive income, because for a lot of people, if you're so busy running the hamster wheel in your day-to-day life, you barely have time to get groceries and a haircut. How are you going to also try to change the structure of your life to be more resilient in the face of some sort of adversity? Where are you going to find the time for that? So I always like to say, you know, not everything in the jungle kills you, and some things just feed into you as long as possible. And I think it's good for people to maybe do an audit of how they're using their day, their life, their time. Are you spending too much time on social media? Are you trying to watch 4 hours of TV a day? Like, what are the things that you're doing? Are you investing a ton of time in traveling to work and back? Is there a way that you could shorten it? Could you carpool with a friend? And at least now you can do something while they drive versus you have to drive all the time and be stuck in traffic. There's 101 more different ways to look at this and go, like, time is the unmanufactured tissue of the universe of your life. And how you use it really matters. And if you can't use it, it's got your hands tied behind your back in terms of changing your life. What would you recommend to someone that was trying to get started to building passive cash flow?
Well, I think the first thing is, you know, it starts with really identifying it and saying, hey, the first investment I make is in myself, right? I'm going to learn. You know, I think that a lot of times we think, oh, I just need a hot tip on what stock or IPO or what investment or what thing to get into. A lot of times it's being willing to learn. And there's a book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which is a great book. The second book in the series called Cashflow Quadrant is a great book. My book talks a lot about this as well. And it's just basically saying, okay, I need to get in the room with people that are doing it, right? Because everything, I remember I first heard the word syndication, which syndication is for me at the time meant, okay, is this like a TV show they're syndicating? Is that was like a term I knew, or like a crime syndicate, or what is that? What does this mean? But the word syndication in the US is just how we pool together. What's that?
Am I doing something illegal?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I didn't know. And so the word syndication is just a legal structure we use to pool together investments to go buy an apartment building or buy a project. And so, but I didn't know that, right? And so until I got in the room with somebody who's like, oh yeah, we do syndication. We invest passively in this. We've been doing it for years, or I've been putting investors into these funds and we're buying these things. And you meet people that, I just think it's really amazing too, when you, a lot of people in finance are trying to sell you something. We're not excluded from that. Like, we have our funds, we raise money from investors. But when a passive investor or somebody who's looking to invest their money meets somebody else who's in the same place as them, but has been doing it for 20 years, that's a transformational relationship, because they're not trying to sell them anything, right? There's no pitch. That's just like, hey, I've worked with these guys. They've worked pretty well. I never invest with these guys again. Here's a mistake I made, whatever. So those relationships are really important. And then you may have to go to a conference. I'm going to the Limitless Conference in July, August this year, which is Ken McElroy's big event. And that's about 2,000 investors and things like that. You get in the room, it kind of normalizes some of this for you, and it helps gives you contacts and mentors in the space so that you can learn. So I think that, again, a lot of times we have these big goals that I'm going to replace my income tomorrow, whatever. It's like, a lot of it's just getting in the room and trying to meet people that are doing it and just being curious. And it will open up kind of your ideas of like, oh, hey, this person, they left their job 10 years ago and now they're a full-time investor. Well, how did they do that? Like, what does that even look like? What do they invest in? What are the wins and losses? And again, sharing about the failures is probably more important than the successes, right? Because, you know, those are, we didn't know what the risks are.
I love that. How do you think AI is going to impact the industry? What are you paying attention to over the next kind of 5, 10 years on the horizon? I mean, is that changing how you're investing?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I think AI, I have a resource I'm putting together for this about how to use AI in your passive investing and investing. Now, you can basically take these documents that are 100 pages or sometimes it's a presentation of a deal, and you put it into ChatGPT and you say, hey, analyze this for me. Tell me, what questions would you ask here? How risky is this? What do you think? Like, it just kind of break it down for you and ask a lot of the questions. And when it's like a legal document, when it comes to some sort of what we call the PPM or the private placement document, these can be 100 pages plus, right? And it's in legal speak. So stuff. You put it in there and you start asking questions. Hey, what should I know as an investor? What are the risks? What happens in this scenario? What happens here? And it's just a huge time saver, right? Because at least you can kind of know what's there, and it's harder than for somebody to sneak something that you didn't even think about. So I think that's definitely something there. I think we're getting better through AI also at identifying deals, being able to identify opportunities that are there, trends. I really think right now, I'd love to know your opinion on this too, Daryl, but I think we're in a time of massive change, almost, I mean, similar to the Industrial Revolution, where it's changing so quickly. I mean, now, like, I called my credit card company to request a new car because I misplaced the other one. And I did it all, just there was like a recorded voice kind of walking me through everything. It was good. And it took about 2 minutes, right? It was so easy. And so over time, I mean, these things are going to displace whole industries. So somebody who's been an accountant, for example, in a short period of time, we say, oh, you know, we've actually automated that. We found a way to do that all through AI, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you're an accountant, it's just important that you learn these skills and you find ways to use AI, adapt with it, and it will create new opportunities, but it's going to create incredible displacement. And that's the part that is a little scary, right? If people are, I've got a daughter who's 12, and how do I prepare her for this ever-changing world, right? It's changing so quickly. And most people have no idea how quickly things are changing right now.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, there's a bit of a philosophical angle to this. I mean, people have been saying we're going to replace humans since, you know, they came out with horses pulling plows. When we had a tractor, we wouldn't need farmers. When we had calculators, we wouldn't need mathematicians. When we had spreadsheets, we wouldn't need accountants. When we had QuickBooks, we're not going to need CPAs. So this has been something that's been over and over. And right now, I feel like we're already cyborgs. Like, you and I are already talking from different sides of the planet via technological devices. They're just not embedded in our skin. So we're already cyborgs. We're already cybernetic species. And so the addition of AI, I don't buy into the whole sentient AI that's going to run away. Like, I think if you create a seek and destroy AI, that's incredibly dangerous because it's not going to stop seeking and destroying. But generally speaking, I just don't fully believe that we're going to create conscious sentient life. I think we can fool ourselves to think that. But part of that, and this comes a bit down to philosophy, is that something that really surprised me is that when you go, fertility clinics have footage of this. You can see when they merge a sperm and an egg, there is a flash of light. You go watch videos of this on YouTube if you want. And that blew my mind, because that means there's a spark inside you. That light really does equal life. And what is that? And some people say, well, scientists say it's a release of zinc. Show me how you can release zinc and create conscious sentient life with an innate understanding of good versus evil. To me, that was a really powerful discovery. And I just don't think that we're going to do that with AI. I think it's a tool. And I think it's an incredibly powerful tool. But I think it's going to be like any other industry that's disruptive because something comes out, you know, like horse and buggies got replaced by cars. And it is getting faster. You're right. We are entering the most competitive era probably in human history, simply because you and I are on different sides of the planet, but we're both working with essentially the same tools and we can both access the whole world. And if we can do it for you too.
It'd be interesting. And I don't necessarily think it's going to be the Terminator, you know, it's going to take over robots or fighting robots and stuff. But I also think I heard a scenario that a couple of years ago I thought was interesting, maybe a year ago. This guy was saying, hey, he's a big thinker. And he just said, you know, traditionally we think about the Terminator and robots and things, but what if, you know, bad actors such as North Korea or some other group would say, hey, we're going to release, you know, 5 deep fake videos a week of, like, you know, racial violence with police in certain markets, and CNN or whoever would just post these without even questioning where they're coming from. And then before they realize they're actually fake, the damage has already been done, right? And, you know, they're also too, like, you'll see these dancing robots. Eventually there's going to be the drones and the military. Like, it's getting a lot more. They're using these in battle, and it is becoming a little more like, okay, this is getting a little interesting, and it is looking a little more like the movies now too. So
the drone wars are coming. They're definitely coming. I mean, it's, again, a $2 million missile versus a $200 drone. Like, what do you, it's a no brainer. Yeah. But the answer is you can't be left behind. I think the solution to that is you have to be able to defend yourself. I mean, I'm not necessarily the world's greatest expert, but I think this is a time that's as old as ever of good versus evil, and almost like a yin yang. This, you know, over the next 2 years, sometimes there'll be more opportunity than difficulty. Sometimes there'll be more difficulty than opportunity, but both will always continue to exist. And we're just marching into the future. And I think, you know, if you need proof of the fractal nature of the universe, just look, humans come out of other humans. It's all, we're all simply little bits of history repeating to a certain extent. You know, it's just a bit different. So it's going to be interesting. I think there is a huge upside, and you have to learn to adopt it, use it as a tool. But also, I think one of the things that you've spoken a lot about, and I was thinking silently and I hadn't said anything, is a lot of what you're doing is focused, like the, it sounds almost like the opposite. I mean, maybe some of the businesses you're looking at buying are digital, but it almost sounds like the opposite, like oil and gas and buying businesses and buying real estate. Like you're really more into the physical world. And I think that that's almost kind of what I'm trying to do. I mentioned Dragon Fruit. Like I've got my online businesses. Sure, I'm trying to make my millions online and I'll do my Bitcoin and all this sort of stuff. But then also I'm just buying, accumulating land and building a homestead and building something that is self-sufficient in terms of it generates enough food to pay its own bills. I got some rental properties on there that I can rent out. And then people can buy the actual type of house that they're in. And I can do this as a resort and, you know, just multi-layered effect. I got online income and offline income. And I think that that's a potentially going to be a strategy to go through forward in the future. I do think people need to be careful. I mean, the Great Depression was people going to the bank going, yeah, I'd like to withdraw the money I gave you. And the bank going, oh, we
don't have it.
And then people lining up down the block waiting for the next delivery of money from the central bank going, hey, where's my money? I gave it to you. I think that there's going to be more concern around things like that as you have AI that learns how to hack stuff, hack ATM code, you know, like all that kind of stuff. Because already your bank account isn't as safe as, and I don't mean to generate a lot of fear here, but your bank account is not the safe place a lot of people think it is. Anyone with scary sounding legalese on a piece of paper can show up at your bank and freeze your account until, you know, the future. There's a lot of people you talk about that have done big launches and generated a ton in sales online only to have the merchant hold onto it for them for 6 to 8 months just to inspect and check. Like there's just 101 ways. So I think that part of that has to be solved. And whether it's the quantum financial system or whatever, who knows? It's going to be exciting. Whee!
It will be exciting. Yeah, it'll be fun to see. And I, obviously looking back, but I do think it's a time to continue to be educating yourself. There's actually some programs out there where there's one called Coursive that our whole team is doing, where it's basic AI programs such as Claude and ChatGPT and Midjourney and what, but like it just kind of builds on and then it gets more and more to like you actually learn how to use these tools and then you start to recognize the patterns and you can be able to use them. So I don't think it's that AI is coming for our jobs, right? It's that the employee using AI or the business using AI is actually going to be really empowered to be able to do it.
Yeah. I mean, it's like giving an account to the calculator. Right?
Yeah.
It's a wonderful tool. So I agree 100%. What are some of the skills or behaviors that you think are really important for someone to develop to succeed?
Well, I think the biggest thing, you know, the more digital everything becomes, Daryl, I think the more personal networks and people that you know and being able to get resources is important. That's why we run a mastermind called the Wealth Forum. We have a free version and then we've got the Elite, which is in person. It's high ticket and we do 4 days a year and we get together. And it's just like having those people that, you know, you can actually verify, okay, this person's real. They live here, whatever. And I know it sounds crazy, but like we're so connected digitally, but we're so disconnected. Like you said, somebody could walk into your bank with the right stuff and freeze your account. Well, having trusted networks and trusted people that you know are solid is so important, right? Mm-hmm. Especially in the investing world or especially in the business world, right? Having those people that you can rely on. And so that's where, you know, when I have a problem or I've got an issue, I've got, you know, one of a few mentors I can call or a few friends, I can say, hey, I've got this issue. What should I do? And I don't think that ever ends. Right? I'm sure you go through things too. You're like, how do I solve this? What would you do here? And that's how we get better. And so I think that really developing those networks, both as a business person, as an investor, as just somebody who's trying to do better and grow, I think it's huge. So I would say that's one of the biggest things is really developing your network.
I love that. I think that's really, really powerful. This has been such a great interview. I've got a page of notes. I do want to be respectful of your time. Is there anything I haven't asked you about I should have asked you about?
No, this has been great, man. I do have a free gift for your audience that I wanted to offer. We have a guide I just wrote. It's right here. It's called the Mailbox Money Blueprint. And it's about 10 pages. It's got a bunch of graphs and things in here, but it's basically like my three favorite cash flow investments of 2025. So again, what actually is cash flow and what's putting money in your pocket today? And if you text the word cash flow, just all one word, cash flow, you text that to the number 33777, we'll basically get that to you. So we'll ask for your name and your email, we'll get that to you, and then we'll let you know about future stuff going on. You can hear about our deals, things like that. So that's kind of what we're working on, and we're pretty excited about it and just new opportunities to come up. Love to connect with anybody if it would be helpful.
I love that. So text cash flow to number 33777. You'll get instructions on how to get a copy of the Mailbox Money Blueprint, as well as you'll be added on the list and be able to stay up to date on what's happening. Is that correct?
That's correct. That sounds great.
Love it. Love it. Love it. Yeah, Brunson, this has been a great call. I think there's great timeless information here, like evergreen nuggets. People may want to listen to this more than once. If other than texting 33777, what are some other ways that they want to check you out? They can go listen to the, what is it, the mailbox, the
Mailbox Money Show, that's another one. Yeah, so
right,
we can do that. We're also on all the socials, and love for anybody to reach out and be able to connect. Yeah, for sure.
Powerful. Brunson, thank you so much for joining us today, knowing that you got your own family, your own direct reports, your own investors, your own projects to pay attention to. Thank you for coming and sharing with my audience tonight so we could all do a little bit better.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Gerald. It's great.